It is said that long before there was gold, there was pepper. The spice that we've all come to know and love as one of our favorite seasonings on basically everything was once but a mythical substance that determined trading routes and even dynasties. Many a wars have been fought and lost for the rights to control and dominate spice trading routes. My guest today, Sana Zaveri Kadri, is on a mission to decolonize the spice trade. And her spice company, Diaspora, based in San Francisco and India, is doing just that. Even her tagline, "Building a Better Spice Trade," alludes to her vision. Now, to understand the mission of Diaspora, you have to understand the spice trade, especially as it relates to India. Whether it was the Arabs in the 5th century or the Greeks and Romans in the 4th century BC, Indian spices ruled the trade routes for several hundred years. Spices like pepper, cloves, and cinnamon were not only used in food, but also for medicinal purposes. Pepper was used to preserve and to flavor spoiled meat. Cloves and cinnamon were used as substitutes for cleanliness and ventilation. They were strewn across the floor to prevent foot odor from permeating the room. Traded by Arabs, many of the spices from the Indian subcontinent made their way all over Europe. Having tasted the magic of the spices and tired of paying a premium for it, the European countries set out to search a sea route to India. Colonization of India and the Americas was a result of such expeditions undertaken by different European nations. Americas was discovered while Columbus was actually searching for East Indies, India, through the Atlantic Sea Route. The original intent of colonial conquest of the Indian subcontinent was actually a desire for domination of the spice trade. A system where farmers made little to no money, spices exchanged hands upward of 10 times between the farmer and the consumer, and the final spice on the shelf was usually an old, dusty, and flavorless shadow of what it once was. With a background in food sciences and consumption and a curiosity of spices in today's food industry, Sana set out to research the origin of spices in India. She says that much of the archaic spice trading practices of the colonial times hadn't really changed that much in today's spice commodity trading. Farmers were still being overworked and underpaid. A meeting with the Indian Institute of Spice Research opened her up to the world of heirloom turmeric, organic cardamom farms, and the whole diaspora of locally harvested spices. She got introduced to farmers who were looking to grow the best of the best, ethically, sustainably, and profitably. Today, Sana is well on her way to do exactly what she set out to do 4 years ago. Decolonize the spice trade in India, partner with and support local farms, encourage fair trade and fair compensation for the Indian farmer, and provide the best quality of spices for her customers. This lovely lady is certainly an inspiration for all small businesses wanting to make an impact in the world. And I cannot wait for you to meet and get to know Sana on this episode of Culturally Ours.
Welcome to Culturally Ours, a show where we explore global cultural diversity in an intimate way through conversations and narratives around lifestyle, culture, food, art, and travel. Host Karthika Gupta talks to people from all over the world who have intimately experienced different cultures as a way to understand each other's worlds from the inside out, focusing on what we have in common.
Welcome, Sana. Thank you so much for joining me on Culturally Ours. I am really excited to have you on the podcast, and I cannot wait to chat with you and get to know you a little better.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on here. To chat about all the cultural spicy things.
Yeah. So before we begin, can you tell us a little bit about sort of who you are, where you're from, just to help set the stage for this conversation, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Sana Jhaveri Kadri. I was born and raised in Mumbai, India. As we discussed, I'm a good South Bombay brat. And then I got a scholarship to go to high school in Italy, to a school that's dedicated to peace and a sustainable future. That led me to then getting a visual art and food studies degree in California. And I now live between Oakland, California and Mumbai, India, running a sustainability and equity focused spice company called Diaspora Co., which I believe we're going to talk plenty about.
Yes, and you've had a very interesting journey so far. And you know what? Living between Mumbai and San Francisco is not a bad thing.
It's not a bad deal. I really wish they were closer so that I didn't have to do that flight so often. But yes, it is a dream. I mean, I was working, you know, a regular job where you only get 2 weeks of the year off. And mm-hmm. I very quickly realized that wasn't going to cut it for me, given that my whole family is in India. I was just like, yeah, that's not going to work. And so I wanted to start something too, was that I wanted to be in India as much as possible while still having my life here. So in that way, best of both worlds.
Absolutely. Now, as you were describing yourself, you said you are an entrepreneur, you're a businesswoman, and you've, from what I see on your website, and I'm quoting your website, you've kind of taken on the task to disrupt and decolonize an outdated commodity spice trading system. I would love to know what that means and what that means to you.
You know, millennials these days, we're a bit ambitious. So I think for me, once I left India, and I think this happens often, is when I really started to study India very deeply and want to engage with it critically and understand our history, understand what's going to fuel our growth and our development as a country. I feel very patriotic towards the future of India and very tied to that. And the more I learned about the spice trade and the history of the spice trade and how tied up it was with colonialism, the more I realized that actually in, you know, the 70 years since colonialism has ended, the spice trade hasn't changed at all. It looks not different from what it looked like when the British were around, when it was set up to simply profit the British. Traders have come in and literally swooped in where the British left it. So nothing has improved about that industry. And the more I learned, the more I felt, you know what, it's almost 2020. It's time somebody changes this. And I've always been somebody who's inspired by social entrepreneurship, who believes in mission-driven businesses. And so I felt that putting our mission out there on the front page of the website would really set the stage for the bar that we're trying to set here.
No, that's fabulous. And I really appreciate your thought into making it vocal, right? I mean, a lot of times, you know, like any business, you see it in maybe like the third page or the fourth page somewhere hidden, or sometimes they don't even have it. So the fact that this is what you firmly believe from your core and you've put it out there for the world to see is very commendable. So I do commend you on that. Now, you said you're tackling this problem, and this problem is as much about, you know, changing mindsets and norms as it is actually changing the industry, right?
Yeah.
So let's go back to the basics a little bit. I mean, how did this whole movement and this desire to change something so ingrained, like you said, 70 years or more, come to be?
Yeah. Are you asking more about my personal desire to change it? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So I always knew that I wanted to work in the food industry. I've known that since I was about 15 years old. I considered becoming a chef. I worked in kitchens. I realized how much I hated it. I considered becoming a farmer. I loved that very deeply, but didn't feel that it was changed at a systemic level. It felt local and not really the work I wanted to do, though I have so much respect and adoration for sustainable farmers. So I knew that this idea of systemic change was very appealing to me, that how can you literally change course on something and on history? And I had seen and studied in undergrad the way the chocolate and the coffee industry had changed in the past 10 years. So coffee and chocolate-like spices were commodities sold on the commodity market. And right. really the entrance of kind of specialty coffee, which is, you know, your Blue Bottles, your Stumptown, and your bean to bar roasters for chocolate, who are making artisanal, very high grade chocolate where you could actually taste the nuance of beans between Tanzania, one part of Tanzania to the other part of Tanzania, but especially from Indian beans to Tanzanian beans, had actually changed the way those commodities of coffee and chocolate were farmed. So it changed the fact that initially the price for chocolate was really, really, really low coming out of these chocolate producing countries. And the bean to bar chocolate movement has actually raised the national price for chocolate in all the chocolate growing countries tremendously. And I found that really amazing, but there was this certain amount of like, well, that's quite elitist, you know, it's
right, right.
It's nice chocolate for rich people. So on one hand, I was critical of it, but on the other hand, I was seeing that because the bar had been set, haha, pun intended. sorry, there are dad jokes coming out of me forever. At the same time, it was pushing big companies like Nestle and Cadbury, which is owned by Nestle, to also improve their practices. So when it comes to food and agriculture and food standards, because the customer can now be so discerning, there is a trickle-down effect. I know trickle-down does not work within economics, but right. I've watched it work within the food system. And so when I started thinking about India and what's happening in terms of agriculture and what India is known for, obviously spices were an obvious answer. But then when I was asking, I was working in a food marketing position here in San Francisco, and I started asking chefs and buyers and just very high up people in the industry where they were getting their spices from and whether the same quality and sort of standards applied to their spices. They would give me these very sheepish responses of, you know, but it's made in India and, you know, it must be organic. And just very half-hearted answers that weren't giving me what I wanted. And I quickly realized that nobody had any idea. And initially, honestly, it started as a research project. As I was a photographer at the time, I was working in marketing. And so I figured maybe I'll photograph the spice farms across India and it'll be an interesting piece for some kind of publication. And so I bought this one-way ticket back to India. I started contacting farmers, farming cooperatives, and nobody was getting back to me. And I was seeing a lot of secrecy, a huge lack of transparency in the industry. You know, in America, if you're well-connected enough, I felt, and I felt very connected in the food industry, I was able to get an introduction or a meeting with just about anybody in the food industry. In right. India, my WhatsApp red receipts would be red and red and red and red. Nobody seemed to want to respond to me. And so eventually I started just showing up places, and I ended up going to the Indian Institute of Spices Research, which is part of the Indian Council of Agricultural Research. And they're an amazing research organization that's been doing really powerful work for many years now. And I met up with them, and they were the ones that really schooled me on the fact that the industry hadn't changed and that it really, really needed an update. And they were showing me all these beautiful heirloom varieties of spices and saying, you know, there's no market for this stuff. Like, the market is still based on what the British built. And when you say, oh, what the British built, I mean, you think of it in the abstract of, oh, they must have built this unjust market. But what the ISR was explaining to me is they literally took all of our spices. So, you know, say turmeric. Turmeric actually has hundreds of different varieties. And they weren't really bothered with what the scientific varieties were, what the indigenous uses were. They were more like, okay, how do we grade this for an industrial system? So they graded, for example, with turmeric, they graded it by color. So if your turmeric was a certain bright orange, ta-da, it made more money. It didn't matter if it was fresher. It didn't matter if it had a higher curcumin content. It didn't matter what the flavor was. So the magic of food is flavor, aroma, and kind of oil content, because oil content boosts both flavor and aroma. And they threw both those things out the window. So they built a system that prioritized color, longevity, so how long it'll last in a bag. And as a result, really made the spice industry much less tasty. And the same applies for pepper, the same applies for chilies. Pepper was graded and measured by size. Now, what does size have to do with how your pepper tastes? I mean, it's like buying the biggest bhindi in the market. Does that mean your bhindi's gonna taste good? No. And so, I mean, I think they really fired me up and was like, oh, wow, this is like a marketing goldmine, you know? If I can take these heirloom varieties and really market them for flavor and quality, it's similar to, you know, a grocery store Walmart tomato compared to like an heirloom farmer's market tomato in summer. Imagine the reaction people will have. Long story short, that's how I got fired up. And with very little money in my bank account and very little idea of what I was doing, I put up a really shitty Squarespace website and bought a very small amount of turmeric from a farmer who they had connected me with and thought, chalo, let's do this. And the rest, I suppose, is history.
No, it's absolutely fascinating hearing you talk about what you discovered. And you're so right that when it's done a certain way for so long, nobody questions it. Nobody bothers to ask those, questions that really come to the crux of the matter, and the fact that why is it based just on color? Shouldn't it be based on taste or, you know, how it flavors the food and things like that, right? Now, of course, you've talked about the challenges that you've faced, and how has it been for you once you sort of started doing this? Has the response been what you expected, far more than what you expected?
Yeah, the response has been far, far more than what I expected. I really thought initially that this was going to be like a cute small thing. At this point, we're probably the number one or number two direct trade spice company out there in the country, which is bizarre to me. But it really tells you how low the bar is, or how low the bar was, and how much room for innovation and disruption there was. It's kind of like, you know, everybody thought Airbnb was a really stupid idea before it actually existed. And now it's giving hotels a run for their money. Similarly, we get emails all the time from people being like, you know, we really cared where our olive oil came from. We cared where our produce came from, but we never thought about our spices. And you've opened up a whole new world to us. And as a home cook, as somebody who has loved food since the day I was born, that is so meaningful and so exciting for us. And it really feels like just the beginning. You know, this year itself, we've gone from turmeric to having turmeric, cardamom, pepper, and chilies. And then next year, we're adding on 10 more spices. So it's thrilling. And, you know, as a young person who, in a lot of ways, is at the very beginning of my career, it's exciting to wake up every day and feel like, yes, my life is hard and it's very challenging. But at the same time, I get to make up the answers and the questions to the work that I do every single day. And I don't think people my age can say that.
No, that's fantastic. And it's you're right, very thrilling. And I guess that's why we get into entrepreneurship, because we want to, you know, we want to do these things, right? And yes, you're right. It's incredibly hard. But it's so rewarding. Even that little tick in the right direction just makes you feel like you can achieve the world.
Super high highs, super low lows.
Right. Hey there. I hope you are enjoying this episode of Culturally Ours. Did you know there are so many wonderful resources, articles, and blog posts on the website to extend your Culturally Ours experience? We also have a library of free resources like a travel guide to some of the most culturally diverse places around the world, a global kitchen essentials cheat sheet, and so much more. Head on over to culturallyours.com/free to grab these, and be sure to check back often as we're constantly adding more resources just for you. Now, let's get back to the episode. Now, when I looked up diaspora, because I really wanted to understand what it meant, the dictionary quoted it as basically
movement when a large group of people, right, of similar heritage move out. And in a sense, it just meant like migration. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're trying to do with your work, kind of make spices more mainstream, not just for the people who use it, but like the farmers and things like that? So it does almost get its place or its shining moment in the sun.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I think I have two taglines that I use a lot, which is one, I want to make supply chain sexy again. And then two is I really want to make spices fun again. And I don't think they've ever been very fun. And that's largely because they were a product of colonialism. But my intention is to really help people understand how they can use spices in their day-to-day life and cooking, but also to shine light on the incredible journey that these spices have taken. You know, I think it's amazing that turmeric, while it was the origin of turmeric as a spice is in India, it then traveled all the way up to Thailand, to the Philippines. And eventually to Venice, there's pasta dishes that were using turmeric by the Venetians in the 1800s and the 1700s. So there is this amazing diasporic history to these spices. I mean, just the fact that cardamom went from being an Indian spice to then being taken by the Mughals, going to the Moors, being used in Spain, and then the Scandinavians being obsessed with anything Moorish and Spanish, and so becoming obsessed with cardamom, and now cardamom being the biggest spice imported into Scandinavia, to then some growers in Guatemala getting cardamom, and Guatemala actually becoming the second biggest cardamom growing region in the world. I think it's a bit of a, just, I guess I'm trying to draw a parallel to the fact that everything immigrates, everything moves. And actually the thesis, and I'm borrowing an amazing writer and editor, Chris Ying's words, in saying that when food moves around, food gets better. And I think that that's true.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's even beyond colonialism, right? I mean, like you said, these spices have history thousands of years old.
Oh,
and
yeah.
With every iteration, it just gets, I don't know, better. Better and better, and
yeah,
you know, start to appreciate even more, right?
Ecuador and Nicaragua would be growing, you know, wild Indian varieties of turmeric. Like, that's to me.
Right. Now, this question is perhaps a little bit more personal, if you don't mind me asking.
Yeah, that's okay.
But I would love to know how starting Diaspora has impacted your life from a cultural perspective.
Mm. That's a good question. I think on one hand, it's given me a very intimate look into India, and forced me to think about big, deep systemic issues of India and how I'm going to interact with them. You know, I'm a third generation Mumbaikar. My family has been deeply involved in the development of Mumbai as a city and India as a country. I come from two generations of architects. But ultimately, I lived a very sheltered Mumbai existence, whereas traveling to, you know, small villages by myself in rental cars all over India, in some ways was a reality check. And in others was, I think, quite a gift in connecting me culturally back to my home country at a time where I wasn't feeling very connected. I came out as queer right before starting the company, and it wasn't a very good time in my life, and it wasn't something that was immediately accepted by my family and community. And the business, I think, gave me a lens with which to reconnect with home, and a way to connect with home that was important to me and a big part of me, but not difficult and I guess filled with strife, which is what the rest of my personal life felt like at the time. Obviously, right. 3 years later, I've come a long way, and my family and community is very on board, and life looks different now, but that took 3 years of hard work. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, Diaspora really saved me and gave me something to pour my heart and soul into and feel connected to. When you come out in a culture that doesn't really accept LGBTQ, values, existence, anything in the mainstream, it's easy to feel very isolated and feel rejected. And I think my work did the opposite for me. And so I felt held and supported.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. Thank you.
But you know, I went into that answer.
But you know, it kind of goes back to something that you told me right at the beginning of this interview, and you said, you know, sometimes being away from all that you know, all that you loved, and all that you are kind of used to, brings back a feeling of being more in love with that thing. Mm-hmm. And I completely understand, you know, kind of going back home with a very different lens, a lens of, I don't know, trying to see the world, see that part of your life, that part of your world with a different lens.
And you've nostalgia and preciousness together.
Yeah, yeah. And you've also kind of gone beyond Mumbai. You talk about this on your social media as well, and you share pictures of being on the farm and, you know, interacting with the actual farmers. So I'm curious, how has that been for you, coming from a Mumbai city girl sort of a perspective?
Yeah, good question. I think the farmers that I work with think that I'm completely mad. over the phone, they think that I'm, you know, maybe some dignified old lady asking them about some spices, or some NGO type who's going to show up and, you know, maybe buy 5 grams. And then this young 20-something shows up with her iPhone and her very strange ideas. And they're kind of just like, what? but for the most part, what they don't realize is that I love farms, and I've worked on farms for all my formative years. From 16 to 21, I was on farms between Italy and the US. And so I feel very connected to these spaces, which shocks them as well, that I'm comfortable in the dirt, that I understand their issues, what they're struggling with. And in many ways, I feel envious of their lives, which I think especially appalls them, that, you know, hotshot city girl who's gone to America actually really loves coming to visit them and spending time with them and understanding more about their lives. It's been a really lovely addition to my life that I get to be a bit of a farm girl as well as a city girl through this business. Recently, as early as last week, my partner came with me to India for the first time, and we visited our new pepper farm together. And it was really, really beautiful to see her interacting with the farmers we now work with, and for it to really feel like a family visit almost.
Yeah. So now 3 years later, do you feel like you, what you've done, what you've achieved, is sort of what you set out to do in the first place?
I think, you know, my mom said this to me a few years ago in a very angsty phase that I was going through, which is really every year. But she said, you know, when you do, we're very similar in that we're both workaholics. We both love our work. We're both perfectionists. She was a tough mom. She is a tough mom, but she's also, you know, my true feminist hero and my idea of success. She said to me that when it does all come together, and when you do attain success, you look back and think how small I was dreaming. And you'll realize that it was bigger and it can be, and it will be bigger and better than you had ever imagined. And I kind of brushed her off as like, Mom, you don't know how ambitious I am. Like, it's not going to be bigger or better than I imagined. But it has been. It really, really has been that I did not imagine what this would become and what the doors it's opened up and what is now possible because of what we've built with Diaspora. So, yeah, it's bigger and better than I imagined, and it's going to keep going.
Oh, for sure. And I just want to say, moms always know best, Sana. You should know by now. I'm a mom, so I can say that. Well, thank you so very much. It's been an absolute delight. I've been watching your work and watching Diaspora, and just I don't know, it's just something about, maybe it's because I'm Indian as well, and seeing somebody kind of do something to, you know, with the intention of bettering the country you're from is very, very rewarding. So thank you so much. Thank you for your time. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you. This was really fun and really sweet.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Culturally Ours. Check out the show notes at culturallyours.com. If you've enjoyed the show, please be sure to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and share it with your family and friends.